Well, thank you, Jess, and good morning, everybody. I'm Michael Johnson. I'm the Dean of the School of Hotel Administration, and I'm going to kick off today's panel. Each of our speakers is going to come up and say a few things, talk a little bit about the history and the ecosystem of entrepreneurship at Cornell, and then we'll get to our Q&A session. So our title today is Cornell's Ecosystem for Innovation and Entrepreneurship, and I'll actually talk a little bit about, you know, how those two things differ. But I want to go back in time to these two guys you see all over the place during CESCWE, Andrew Dixon White and Ezra Cornell. Cornell's entrepreneurship blueprint really goes back to these two gentlemen and their histories and how they started this university. If you think about Andrew Dixon White and his educational philosophy, well, first think about his background. I don't know if we have any Yale graduates in here, do we, as well? Good, so we can sort of... I can speak to that point because part of this is a criticism of the actual staid, sort of boring education that Andrew Dixon White got at Yale. Anybody also got a degree at Michigan? All right, well, at Michigan, he went to Michigan and he got enlightened. So Andrew Dixon White got his education at Yale. It was a very, very traditional education, a lot of rote learning, a lot of the classics. He went to Michigan, and what he saw, he was a history and English professor there. It was his first job out of his PhD program. And what he saw was in a very applied curriculum, and a very different curriculum. And that led to an educational philosophy that featured a couple of things. There's actually a lot of different elements to his educational philosophy, but there's two that are important for us. One is called the theory of value, which is what is the education for, what is it designed to do, and one is the theory of learning, that is how are the skills and the knowledge acquired. And in his theory of value, he talked about his time at Michigan exposing him to these very practical curriculums, civil engineering, applied physics, other things that help people actually accomplish tasks in the everyday world. Likewise, you know, Ezra Cornell wanted to prepare students to advance the country's economy. We were in the midst, Cornell was formed in the midst of what was called the Second Industrial Revolution. There was a ton of technology being developed. It was mechanical technology. But what Cornell was interested in is how you took that technology and made it work for people, how you develop practical solutions to everyday problems for people. So there's very much a consistency between the two educational philosophies. In the theory of learning, you know, White talked about how learning should satisfy the wants and needs of the how we do things. And Cornell said that students should investigate science to master practical applications of everyday life. Again, this was a point in time in the late ends of the Industrial Revolution where the middle class was growing tremendously, and it was all about creating value for the economy and growing the middle class. We can jump forward now and look at some comparisons between Ezra Cornell and some more modern-day figures. I mean, Cornell himself went from being a carpenter to a mechanic to he was out of a job at the age of 30. He eventually developed a company that merged with another company called Western Union, and that's where he made all of his money. My wife and I were talking about how he gave $500,000 at the time to found Cornell University. And back then, that was a lot of money. But I came across a great article that I'm used to sort of wrap my segment up. And it was by a fellow by the name of, it was in Forbes magazine about a year ago, a fellow named Ron Yappel. And he wrote an article comparing Steve Jobs to Ezra Cornell. His first comparison was they were not born to wealth. From the earliest years, they had to scramble to survive and move ahead. And this gets into the arguments against inherited wealth and the importance of entrepreneurship, again, to build the middle class. They chose businesses that showed increasing returns to scale, where the value to each customer increases as more customers are added. Again, that's as true today, if you think about what Steve Jobs has done. In the School of Hotel Administration, we think about what Chuck Feeney did. And again, some of the same lessons hold. He built tremendous scale in his businesses. Both of them were not innovators or technicians per se. I think, and this is the important distinction, we talk about innovation, you know, we talk about technology, but neither one of them were technicians or scientists per se. What both Steve Jobs did and what Ezra Cornell did
was they had the vision to see the potential of the innovations of others. They made the technology usable. So they made the inventions easy to use by non-technical people. Six, they were not disheartened by failure of their early products. They didn't quit. Rather, they learned from those failures. This is a classic characteristic of entrepreneurs. They have to be able to take failure, learn from it, come back, and try again. Seven, Jobs and Cornell brought intense focus to detail, designing and executing the details of their products to maximize the value to their customers. Attention to detail can make or break any entrepreneur. And finally, they both had major health setbacks, but they kept going. They persevered. So accepting failure, dealing with it, learning from it, coming back, overcoming personal challenges from a health standpoint, these are all as true today for the entrepreneurs we're producing here out of Cornell as they were 150 years ago. I'm going to turn things over now to Diane.
Hi, I'm Diane Burton. I'm a professor in the ILR School, and I'm an entrepreneurship researcher. So I'm happy to be here to have an opportunity to talk a little bit about research. And actually, in particular, I'm going to talk about some research that we're doing. We're analyzing an alumni survey that was conducted as part of the Tech Campus bid. This is a survey of all of the Cornellians, and I'm just going to give you some quick highlights of what we're learning from this survey. I want to thank the Alumni Affairs Office, in particular Jennifer Cunningham, and also June Sohn, a PhD student who's been working with me on this. But before I talk about Cornell, I just want to put this in context, because I think many of the people in the room are going to be surprised to learn that entrepreneurship is actually declining in the U.S. And it's a cause for concern. This is some research being done at the Kauffman Foundation. They've looked at Census Bureau data, and what they're seeing is a pretty steady decline over time in the number of firms that are being founded and in the proportion of new firms as a percent of the total. And so I want that to be in the backdrop, right? We're looking from 1978 to 2012. And later you're going to hear about some of the things we're doing here at Cornell to try and turn this around. Okay, this is a survey that was conducted as part of the Tech Campus bid. It was a survey that went out to Cornell alumni. Now, we actually sent the survey out to 147,000 people, but there are 300,000 living Cornell alumni. 235,000 of them are reachable by mail, and only 150,000 or so are reachable by email. And so this is a plea. Please update your contact information so that when we send surveys out, we can reach you and please respond to us. We were thrilled to get a 10% response rate from the alumni who were surveyed. It was done a couple years ago, back in 2011. Again, not surprising given that it was an email survey, more recent cohorts of graduates were much more likely to respond to this survey. And so people who graduated in the 2000s, right, we had a 40% response rate, and it declines as you go back in time. Now, this has huge implications for how we can generalize about the survey results, and we've done incredible statistical handsprings to try and correct for this, try and generalize to the overall alumni population. And so I'm going to share with you the predicted probability that corrects for the response bias and the probability that we were able to reach you and the chances that we had an email mailing address. And what we learned from this is that Cornell has long been entrepreneurial, right? Starting with graduating back in the 40s, we have a very entrepreneurial population. That's the red line is the predicted probability. The gray boundaries are kind of confidence intervals around those predicted probabilities. We're seeing a similar decline in the recent period, but not nearly as dramatic as you see in the Kauffman Foundation data. And in our data, there are two explanations for this, right? People tend to become entrepreneurs later in their life. And so the people who graduated early have a much longer period in which they can try to entrepreneurship or try to start a company. And so maybe some of these recent cohorts will ultimately become entrepreneurs. They just haven't yet. We looked at the demographic differences. And so we looked at gender differences, whether you are native-born or foreign-born, and whether you are white or non-white. And so on the left-hand side, I just have an on-average bar graph. We see big gender differences. Men are almost twice as likely to be entrepreneurs as women. There's a slight advantage or a slight increased propensity of the foreign-born to be entrepreneurs than the US-born. We see no differences by race among Cornellians. But then if you look at the changes over time, which is the graph to the right, we have some, I think, very good news there. The gender gap is decreasing over time. Right, so we see women are catching up to men. That's the declining red line. Similar for the foreign-born versus US, the gap, the nativity gap, and again, the race gap is non-existent over time. And then the thing I'm sure you're most interested in, differences by college. And so I know this is very hard to read. Two points I want to make with it. So we've got all of the colleges plotted over time, and this is the predicted probability of entering entrepreneurship. You want to notice that the gap on the left side of the graph is bigger than the gap on the right side of the graph. So we're seeing all colleges, right, the differences across colleges are shrinking over time. There's also some surprising findings. If we look back in the 50s, which colleges were the most entrepreneurial? The law school and the vet school. Hotel, art, architecture, and planning, right? I think this starts to indicate where, what kinds of businesses do entrepreneurs start, right? And early on, it was people who were starting their own sole proprietorships, their own solo practices. We see changes over time when we look in the 60s. Again, art, architecture, and planning, vet, but also hotel and law are there. In the 60s, still art and architecture and the vet school are very entrepreneurial. But we see the emergence of human ecology. So I'm always highlighting the four most entrepreneurial schools. And it's not until the 80s that we see engineering pop up to the top and the Johnson School. Then in the 90s, Johnson Hotel. And the most recent period, art, architecture, planning, hotel, Johnson. I didn't plot all four because there's not much different. There's kind of the three front runners and the last. Okay, what are our headlines? Cornellians have long been entrepreneurial. We see some demographic differences, but these are shrinking over time. Yes, there are college differences, but those are shrinking over time. Thanks very much.
Well, good morning once again. My name is Zach Schulman. I direct the university-wide entrepreneurship program at the university. I like to explain that by saying I report to 13 deans, and people typically then feel sorry for me. But the reality is that the 13 deans all embrace the program, and I'm going to show you a slide in just a moment that actually shows that. Diane just mentioned some really sound research approach. I'm going to talk more about what we have going on at Cornell for our students. First and foremost, it's critical to understand that the students are the number one customer. So everything we do is for the students, right? Without the students, we wouldn't really have a program. And our discovery through growth phases, so discovery, validation, demonstration, market entry, and growth are all about helping students pursue businesses. So I think of our office, entrepreneurship at Cornell, as really an enabler of allowing students to start, grow, and then hopefully prosper in their businesses. So the discovery aspect does start with the deans. I really do challenge you to find a large institution where every dean of every college at the university supports one program. Right, so here at Cornell, we actually have that, and it is quite extraordinary. And it's not just supporting it financially, which they all do, but it's really supporting it with their mindset. Four of the deans are here. So Michael, Sumitra, Lance, and Catherine are all here. And those are probably the main four. I'd add ILR to that mix as well. But even the other schools where there's not as much entrepreneurial activity, there is a ton of students in all those schools who are really pursuing it. So all the deans recognize that. And they really have circled around entrepreneurship and support it with really their hearts, which I fully appreciate. Then discovery goes into the classroom. Right, so we have over 65 courses spread out throughout the university in our different schools and colleges that we call entrepreneurial related. Right, we've pared that down. We used to have like 120, but that list kind of got out of hand. And when I took over the office a couple of years ago, we cut that back because it made more sense. So it's everything from classic business planning to lean startup approach to design thinking to even accounting and entrepreneurial finance. But it's really spread out nicely across the entire university. And then once you take courses, you want to actually validate your ideas. Now, I'm not going to go through each of these individually, but suffice it to say that we have competitions, whether they're business plan competitions or business idea competitions, in many schools and colleges. So hotel school, engineering, my office sponsors one itself. There's actually a couple in engineering. We have Pop Shop, which is a co-working space where students literally hang out and do their businesses and collaborate with one another. We recently started the Student Business of the Year Award, which is in its second year now. But again, we've always recognized the Entrepreneur of the Year. This morning, Sandy Weil spoke. He is one of the first Entrepreneurs of the Year. And now we have this year Bob Langer, who is a prolific inventor from MIT, is our current Entrepreneur of the Year for 2015. And at the end of the validation pathway, we need to give students a place to actually live. And this is what we're calling eHub as a working name. eHub is one of our marquee programs, and eLab, just to confuse you, it is another. Sumitra's laughing because he always teases me about the names. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about eHub in just a moment, but let me focus on eLab for just a second. So eLab is a partnership between Student Agencies Foundation and EITC, and it literally is a business accelerator for students. So it's a competitive process. Students enter in October. There's typically about 40 or 50 students that apply as teams. We select 10 or 12, and then those students go through coursework and intense mentorship. So Tom and Ken are both here from the eLab team. And they actually give courses to those students through the Johnson School, and they end up getting up to 5.5 credits. The credit scheme was just put into place 2 years ago, and it's incredibly helpful for students because these kids are really spending a ton of time on their businesses. And now for eHub. So we really need a place for students to actually live and breathe and do entrepreneurship. These are renderings of our proposed space in Kennedy Hall. We're building 4,000 square feet, actually right outside this door. So up and to the left will be our new eHub space on campus. Okay, we're building 10,000 square feet in the Student Agencies building off campus. The agencies partnership, again, is absolutely critical because students cannot run businesses on campus for one reason. This is the technical one I always give. So we have lots of space off campus right in College Town where most of the students live. Right, and they can start their businesses and actually run them there. So two spaces, one on campus, one off campus. It's going to be awesome space. I hope to actually be moved in. Actually, EITC is moving into Kennedy Hall. I'm into this space. I hope to be there early next spring. So quickly again on status for eHub, 14,000 square feet. It's a lot of space. Right, it's not quite as big as Harvard's iLab, but it's compared to most other schools in the country, it is going to be absolutely grand. Right, a place to do entrepreneurship. Right, the current status is we're fundraising now. Student Agencies has already broken ground and started demoing one of their floors in 409 College Ave. Right, but the whole purpose here is to truly build community for our students. It's going to end up being exactly that. It's also worth pointing out that every dean that I mentioned, their schools and colleges are actually supporting eHub financially. With the annual operating budget, and they've gotten behind it on the fundraising front as well. When students leave Cornell, so if they graduate, we always like when they stay here. It doesn't happen that often, but I'll tell you this, it's happening more and more. I mean, it truly is. So now we have a space downtown called Rev, which is currently about 5,500 square feet, growing to over 10,000 square feet soon, because Ithaca, in case you haven't noticed, downtown's growing up, right? So there's new floors being built. And that space is wonderful, right? So students can actually leave Cornell, enter our community in Ithaca, stay here and grow and contribute vastly to our economic development. We also have a wonderful incubator on campus, which I refer to as the McGovern Incubator for Life Sciences. Kevin McGovern and his family endowed that a number of years ago. And that incubator has about 6 businesses in it now. There's extra space in case you have any ideas that are life sciences oriented, you should apply for sure. So it's really, really vibrant. And that concludes what I want to say, but our system here in our progress, you know, I've been at Cornell since 1997, it's truly an order of magnitude different than when I first got here. There are students that are just scrambling to start their own companies, and we do everything we can to support them. Great, thank you. Smitra.
Thank you, Zach, and good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us for this session. My name is Sumitra. I'm the Dean of Johnson School. It's very hard to talk about entrepreneurship at Cornell today if one does not talk about Cornell Tech. Now, Cornell Tech is something that we're all proud of. You know, Cornell beat Stanford. That's something important. And the entire proposal process by which we won was driven by many at Cornell, but certainly Lance Collin, the Dean of Engineering, Dan Huttle-Locker, then the Dean of CIS, Ken Fox, the previous provost, and David Scotton played a key role in driving the entire process. How many of you have been to the Google space where Cornell Tech is running right now? Just raise your hand. Okay, a large number of you. So some of you haven't been there, but Cornell Tech does not exist today as you see it in the picture. So if you actually go to the island today, you will see a huge, you know, construction site in operation. There's a webcam that gives you real-time pictures of the construction site if you're interested. But this is what the first phase of the campus will look like in 2017. And this will be an important development for Cornell and certainly also for New York City. I don't know if many of you joined the last panel in Bailey Hall on global financial markets. And one of the last comments made by Abby Cohen-Joseph was that she really thanked Cornell for participating at a micro level in the redevelopment renewal of the economy of New York City. Because that's what Cornell Tech is about. It's about helping attract professionals, a new generation of professionals in New York City. It's about creating new businesses, and it's about stimulating and renewing existing businesses in the city. And in many ways, I think Cornell Tech represents the future role of a university in stimulating entrepreneurship and development in an economic area. It's a unique partnership of a government, the New York City government, of a university, in fact, in this case, two universities, Cornell and Technion. You have also the private sector, very involved in various factors. The building, which is to the south side facing Queens, is called the Corporate Co-location Building. That's a building where we expect companies to come and base their employees and to work in close collaboration with Cornell professors and students and help create and spawn new businesses, sometimes startups, sometimes new ideas inside their own companies. So city government, education, universities, private sector, and also, very important, the fourth element in the partnership is civil society. Cornell Tech does believe in engagement with civil society, and all professors at Cornell Tech, for the first time, are required to spend a certain number of hours teaching and interacting with local middle school students. In fact, one of the recent hackathons that was held in Cornell Tech was held at the local middle school in Roosevelt Island, because certainly that's seen as an important way in which the university and its talent can help inspire young minds in this area. Now, what's Cornell Tech about? Clearly, there are many different ways to describe it, but some buzzwords or some important phrases do stand out. The first word is digital. So Cornell Tech is about a belief that the digital technology developments that we are seeing around us is in fact transforming businesses fundamentally, is enabling, is creating new forms of business in the future. And Cornell Tech really is about actual research and practice in this new business models which are being enabled by progress in fundamental technologies. It's very important to keep in mind that the way we see the digital phenomena in Cornell Tech is complementary to perhaps how Silicon Valley or the Bay Area sees digital. We see digital much less so as a vertical, but much more so as a horizontal layer of enabling technologies that are helping transform finance, media, fashion, design, healthcare, retail, and all the different business segments that make up the economy of New York City, and in many ways make up the economy of any thriving metropolitan area today. So this transformation that Cornell Tech is focusing on is on the digital economy. It's not just in the narrow ICT perspective. The second important phrase is entrepreneurial, but by which we do not necessarily mean only creating startups. Of course, creating startups is an important part of the endeavor, and we certainly see many of our students creating startups, but it's much more about an entrepreneurial mindset. It's about trying to take people and getting them to question what is possible, and push the boundaries of the imagination, and to, in fact, inspire them in teams to achieve the impossible. So this kind of an entrepreneurial mindset is something that we see is very important, not just for creating startups, but also for driving entrepreneurial activity inside existing large companies. And this goes back to the phenomena I said earlier about us trying to focus on the renewal and revitalization of existing sectors in New York City. So digital and entrepreneurial mindset are two key elements, but let's not forget, Cornell Tech certainly values practice, but it is not just another practice institution or an incubator. It is also an academic research university. So the roots are really in academic research and academic disciplines, and that's one reason why the focus really in Cornell Tech is to integrate the best of Cornell research, the best of Cornell faculty, with the best of industry, the best of practice, the best of this unique, innovative entrepreneurial ecosystem in New York City. And what better can we do than to link the talent and the power that we have among students and faculty in Ithaca and also emerging in New York City with the unique innovation ecosystem in New York City. So just as we look at Cornell Tech helping drive innovation in New York City, let's also not forget that Cornell Tech represents a unique opportunity for us as a university to be entrepreneurial ourselves, to look inwards and ask the question, how can we do things differently? Or as Dan Hutton Locker, the dean of the Cornell Tech campus, often puts it, how can we use Cornell Tech to experiment, to be bold, and try to discover what will university education look like in the 21st century? And I can tell you that inside Cornell Tech, there are a number of wonderful experiments ongoing. Some will succeed, some may not succeed. But the important thing is we are experimenting. Now, one important element, some examples of that is faculty in Cornell Tech do not have offices. For those in the corporate world, you might think, what's the big deal? But believe me, for faculty members who are used to the comfort of the closed office environment, being in cubicles next to staff members and secretaries and everyone else is a whole different cultural mindset. If you go to the Google space where Cornell Tech now exists, the desk space of the dean of the campus is exactly the same size and the same adjacency to other staff members, including a secretary. The faculty members have cubicles which are completely intermixed. So you might have a professor from computer science sitting next to a professor of business and vice versa. The same kind of mixing is encouraged very strongly amongst the students. This is a picture of the current student population. If you actually go and look at the students, they're all great students. And at the same time, it's very hard to tell the difference who's an MBA student, who's an MNCIS student, who's a student in some other discipline. Why? Because they spend the entire time working together, rubbing shoulders, and really in many ways, what we hope, they will become leaders who will help create the next version of the digital economy in the industry that they choose to operate in. And I can give you a number of examples of how successful they have been, but this certainly is the best representation of the living experiment that we're conducting with Cornell Tech. And I certainly do hope that you will be engaged with many of the activities in Cornell Tech and also in Ithaca that will link Ithaca and Cornell Tech together. Thank you very much.
My name is Deborah Streeter, and I'm a faculty member in the Dyson School, which is in the College of Ag and Life Sciences. Thanks to the family of Bruce F. Failing Sr., I have an endowed chair in that area, for which I'm very grateful. I'm really here to talk, to put a face on what we've been talking about, and really to talk about the entrepreneurial Cornellians. So I'm going to cover, show you a lot of faces and play some video. And all of them come from a large collection of digital video that I can share with you later if you're interested. But when I went to look among them, the collection has more than 1,000 individuals. I'm like, who should I bring to this audience? What makes sense? Who should we bring? And I thought about how many big problems the world is facing today. And I thought, well, who among the Cornell population is really working on some of these big issues? And the first person that came to my mind was Jen Dulski. She was an arts and sciences grad from 93. Jen started at Yahoo and then started a company of her own called DealMap that was bought by Google. But eventually she found her way to leading change.org, which is a for-profit company that's using a crowdsourcing approach to making big changes in the world. And that's a really exciting sort of big meta in the meta area. And then I started thinking, well, what about in education and inequality? And Angie Dada Kamath came to mind. She was a grad from the late 90s. And Angie runs the New York Perscolas organization. They take underemployed and individuals in New York City and help train them to be in the IT world. So that's something that's really going to change their lives quite a bit. Climate change, there were so many choices here, I didn't really know who to pick, but I love Dan Goldman, so I picked him. He's a previous student of mine, he's also a graduate of the Johnson School, I believe. And Dan started Great Point Energy, but even more, I think, impactful, he runs a venture firm that's focused on clean tech. And if we don't get some money and some momentum going in the clean tech arena, we're gonna be in trouble with our climate. Dan Kane also came to my mind. It wasn't enough for him that he co-founded Blackboard, which really impacted education. He decided to move over to healthcare. So his company, he was also a graduate of the Dyson School, his company is modernizing medicine, and they're really revolutionizing the way that doctors are capturing and sharing information that's going to change how diagnostics are done. Many of our students, as Zach pointed out, are starting companies, but really the majority of people impacted by entrepreneurial education aren't starting companies. They're working entrepreneurially, as was mentioned by Sumitra. They're working entrepreneurial with a mindset in other places. And Frank Martinez, who I think is an engineering grad, is working at Intel on digital literacy at the base of the pyramid. This is an inequality area as well. Diversity and inclusion, Lawrence Watkins, a graduate of the Johnson School, is working. He started Great Black Speakers, and he himself has become a very outstanding speaker, sort of spreading and diversifying the faces that people are seeing across the country. Cheryl Wudun, I wanted to do something about global and gender inequality, and she came to mind because she has always had a heart for females, especially children, in China. She co-wrote Half the Sky, and then started the Half the Sky Foundation, which really works on women's issues, especially children, female children, in developing contexts. Then you've got Bobby Abrams, all the way back from the 50s, who's really been trying to change the face of manufacturing in this country, bringing some of it back, innovating, especially in the area of agriculture. We have somebody who's going to be marching in May, Jake Reich, who's started a company that is really focused on the reducing the isolation of the elderly. It's a wireless headset company. It's a system that helps people in assisted living environments connect better to the movies and the speakers and the music that are present in those settings. So that's another sort of really young entrepreneur that came to my mind. And then I love Maria Pacheco. She's a MPS grad from 90, and she created a co-op environment in Guatemala that creates these beautiful bracelets and jewelry, and now she's bringing them into the developed world as a marketing channel. So you can see where they're Cornellians, and this is just a smattering of Cornellians that are working all over the place for on these big issues. You might think, well, what about digital and tech? So much change is happening there. And I'm not going to introduce every face on this screen, but you can recognize the names. They're big names like Google and Yahoo and PayPal. But there are also these new innovations like Lyft and Yext and CanDo and Distinct and Next Broadband Generation. So they're both at the very early stage innovations, and the established companies were very well represented in the tech sector. What about faculty? Are we just sitting around writing academic papers, or are we really doing something useful? And it turns out if you go to the Center for Technology Licensing, you'll see a whole cadre of faculty members who have spun out companies. I'll give you one example. Dr. Harold Van Es has a technology that uses soil data and weather data to help farmers reduce their use of nitrogen on fields. And that company is going great guns. Two of the people that run the business are Cornellians, so it's a really great success story. And they came out of, they were the first graduate, I believe, of the McGovern Center. So the faculty are also involved. But then I started thinking, you know, these are all really smart people, the faculty, the students, the alums. Maybe if we just don't screw them up, they'll do well. Does really being at Cornell matter? How do we change what they do? And I think, watching these Cornellians over my almost 30 years here, that being at Cornell is mattering more and more to them. So I looked around and I found a short clip from two entrepreneurs, Neeraj Shah and Steve Conine, who you'll see from the clip started a company while just out of school. Now they are co-owners of Wayfair, which has a market cap of $2.7 billion, so they've been very successful. But here's a little bit about their presenting. This is from their presentation at the New York Summit, Cornell Summit, and this is what they said about their days at Cornell.
Our journey is actually that of two Cornell entrepreneurs. We actually started our first company out of Cornell. So the way we met is we were three doors apart on our freshman year floor at Cornell, and then without really planning it, we ended up starting a company right out of Cornell. And the reason we did that, we were Cornell engineers. One of the elective courses we took, our very last semester, was the entrepreneurship course in the Johnson School at the time for undergraduates, which was the only entrepreneurship course.
Those are the bookends, right? They started in proximity to other entrepreneurial people. So being at Cornell made a difference in who they ran into and who they decided to be with. And then they took David Ben-Daniel's class, and they learned how to write a business plan, and they started a company that they ended up selling, and then they started Wayfair. So that's an example from the 90s of how being at Cornell mattered. Let's get more modern and look at Kareem Abulgnaga. And he started Practice Makes Perfect while he was in college. It's a company that really looks at the underprivileged youth in the inner city of New York and the summer period that they don't have school. And how could he address the gap that happens because they're not in school over the summer? So this is shot in the Leland C. and Mary M. Pillsbury Institute, one of the co-working spaces on campus. And Kareem is going to talk, this was shot when he was a student, and he'll talk about how being at Cornell impacted him.
I personally came into Cornell as a hotel administration major. I was interested in business and financial services, and I never thought, as I was applying to the school, that I'd be a student entrepreneur or running a nonprofit organization. And so that in and of itself should speak volumes to the amount of support that exists for people who may not have thought about it before. Yeah, I had this traditional or non-traditional like business background that may have lent itself to the opportunity, but it's not until you get here and you take advantage of the places like the Pillsbury Institute and people like Neil who are there to support you and provide you the
And so while, when he came here, it was the combination. He didn't intend to be an entrepreneur, but it was the combination of his drive and the resources that were here. And if you want to see what Kareem is doing today, he was also a speaker at the New York Summit, and you'll be very impressed with the progress he made from when this was shot to when this was shot. Now he has 10 employees. Several of them are Cornellians. He's employing 30 teachers this summer. And this is just the beginning of a program that he's going to scale over the whole country. He was named one of the Forbes 30 Under 30. And here is a description of his business model, and you'll be impressed by the sophistication.
So we built this model. We took kids who were academically struggling, paired them with higher achieving mentors from the same inner city neighborhoods because they could relate to the adversity that the kids were facing. They had the same teachers, grew up in the same environment, single parent, low income, whatever it may have been. And then we threw them under the supervision of passionate college students, creating a national teacher development pipeline, one that doesn't exist yet, and then took the teacher out of the classroom and brought them back as evaluators and coaches.
This guy is like 22 years old. I just feel better about education. I feel like something is going to happen that's going to make a big difference in people's lives because of Kareem, of who he is, of coming to Cornell, of interacting with things here. So if we, I wanted to end the session with an inspirational quote from, or speech from Jay Walker, just a part of his speech when he was Entrepreneur of the Year. Jay founded Priceline.com, which I'm sure all of you have heard of, but he's also deeply involved in TEDMed, which is looking at all kinds of medical innovations. This is part of his address, and I thought we should listen to this as if he's talking to us today.
Okay. Most of all, okay, you're entrepreneurs. You're the vanguard. You're the explorers. You're the leaders who break new ground, pave new paths, try new ideas. It bears repeating. In all of human history, there has never been an opportunity like this. Individuals who create small teams with the right solutions can create massive wealth while intentionally helping the whole planet. Hunger, poverty, healthcare, disease, climate change are much more than your generation's biggest challenges. They're also your generation's biggest entrepreneurial opportunities. If you want to be an entrepreneur, we need you. The world needs you. We need your passion, your idealism, and your business smarts. And we need you to put all this together in a way that's never been thought of before. You can be the generation that harnesses the power of self-interest in the service of community interest and fuses them so completely that it's impossible to tell where one begins and the other ends. I know you can do it. The world's counting on you. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
So I think that's a great inspirational place to end. We have revisited Cornell's foundations, and we've looked at some of the data. We've understood this university-wide model, toured the ecosystem, visited the future with Cornell Tech, and now seen the faces and listened to the entrepreneurs. So at this point, we are going to move over to the question and answer period, and I'm going to invite our speakers to come up here and sit for the Q&A. And we have some people with mics who can bring a mic to you if you have a question about anything that was spoken about today. So please come on up.
So one speaker mentioned the luminous past of Cornell's entrepreneurial tradition. I'm wondering, just curious, how is Cornell compared to other universities of the same standing?
How does Cornell compare to other universities? Is that, have I got that right? How does Cornell compare to other universities in its the way it presents entrepreneurship?
Good one for Zach.
Everyone's looking at me.
Yeah.
I love when people look at me. So, I mean, it's a fabulous question. Again, I think that because we're such a large university, you know, not only are we the largest Ivy, but we're a nationwide, a very large school, that having this university-wide model is actually the way to go. So you have all these schools and colleges that are doing their entrepreneurial pursuits, and this university-wide office simply supports them. So we have our own programming, and then we support them as well. I think that this is working very, very well. The one piece of data that I like to always point to is a recent PitchBook survey, which ranked schools by the number of alumni that have received venture backing. Okay, so domestically, Cornell was number 6, which probably would surprise a lot of you. Right, in the schools that were there ahead of us, Stanford, MIT, Berkeley, which are typically the top 3, and then Harvard and Penn. So Stanford, MIT, Berkeley, Harvard, Penn, Cornell. And there wasn't much difference between the bottom 3. I say bottom 3, the second 3. So, you know, it's really, you know, we are doing the right thing. And it's a mindset that we put in the students early, and we support them all the way through.
Just to add to that, I would say, you know, we did a study in the early 2000s of other models of entrepreneurship education. And Cornell is one of the few places where this university model is really working. The Kauffman Foundation, based on much of what was going on at Cornell, started funding university-wide education across the country. And some of those have been successful, but really not, I think, because it started that way here, it's really stuck, and it's really sort of part of the Cornell model.
Yeah, I was just going to add that a fellow named Mike Levins ran the Kauffman Foundation. You know, for a while, we talked to him early on when we were developing the Pillsbury Institute. And most models on these other campuses are what's called magnet models. You know, you have an entrepreneurship program in one place on campus. It's typically in business or engineering, and it draws everybody. It's supposed to draw everybody there. From the get-go, entrepreneurship at Cornell has been a network-based approach. And one of the things that Levins reinforced when we were developing, you know, these different entrepreneurship activities across campus is that's how entrepreneurs work. Entrepreneurs work in a network. They don't work in a magnet approach. They work in a network approach.
And until this talk, I had this preconception that entrepreneurs were born and not made. And some of the personality traits, I think Dean Johnson mentioned, the ability to accept failure and rise above, the appetite for risk. These kinds of personality traits seem to be important in entrepreneurship. So I'm just wondering, how can the university contribute to those kinds of less tangible factors that personally may create a successful entrepreneur?
Speak to this quickly?
Please do.
So actually, the evidence on personality is quite mixed and quite complex. And in many ways, we see a wide range of personality types that are able to both enter entrepreneurship, and become successful entrepreneurs. And in fact, the bulk of the evidence really is showing that context matters enormously. We see cross-national differences in rates of entrepreneurship. We see local environmental differences in rates of entrepreneurship. It really speaks to the fact that the environment in which you find yourself matters. And I think what our panel has shown is that this is a vibrant and entrepreneurial environment, that we're doing a lot to kind of just, it's in the water here, and that is making a difference.
Matters a lot is we have to give students an opportunity to fail, and I don't mean fail their class, but I mean fail and recover. At Cornell, these kids are coming in even increasingly now. They are like in college and high school. They have to have all their ducks in a row to get into Cornell. And so everything is focused on succeeding and being success and being a successful leader. And when they get to college, a lot of the courses are more focused on, you know, successful and learning things. The entrepreneurship classes are these really, you know, they're put into these really ambiguous situations where they're gonna fail. Their teams are gonna struggle, their idea development is gonna get, you know, pivoted, and they're very uncomfortable with it, but it's probably one of the most valuable things we can do. All the personality trait stuff aside, I think that opportunity to fail and know that you can recover and be resilient, I think is one of the strongest things we can do.
If I can just add to that, you know, one of the points I mentioned in our thinking about Cornell Tech is true to the Ithaca campus too, is entrepreneurship is not just about starting a company after graduation. That certainly does happen, a certain proportion of students. But as the survey results show, many students start their companies later on. It's really about a mindset, a state of mind. And the question is, the more we can support that in the way we structure the environment out here, in the way the courses are designed, the way we provide support for them to explore and to be inspired, and the more successful we will be as a university in stimulating entrepreneurship in the entire community.
I wanted to follow up a bit on the comments made about the campus, New York Tech. You were talking about the possibility for the fact that the interdisciplinary engagement of students and so forth would create some unique successes, and suggested that some already have occurred. So I wondered if you might give us some idea of what has happened from this kind of effort.
Yeah, so right now on the Cornell Tech campus, the students essentially come from two groups, two large groups. So one is engineering slash CIS, so that's one group. Another group is the business and the MBA population. In the future, that group will enlarge to include other kinds of populations. In planning is the creation of an LLM program more focused on startups and other kinds of similar legal issues around younger companies. So we'll have some law students also entering into the picture. The discussions are ongoing with the Weill Medical College. Healthy Living is one of the hubs inside Cornell Tech, and the many increasing relationships across the medical school and Cornell Tech. So if you think about this unique ecosystem that's being created, we are trying to bring in different backgrounds, and we are trying to actually put them to work, to learn, and to create at very close proximity in very intense situations. What are example successes so far? The students at Cornell Tech, the MBA and the MEng students, they have about more than one-third of the curriculum which is completely fused together. It's not just taking cross-listed courses. Really, the curriculum is completely fused. It's called the studio curriculum. And the studio curriculum requires them to work in multifunctional teams on both small business creations and also on larger business sort of ideas and projects inside larger companies. Now, what we're finding is that that kind of interaction is great for getting these two communities to work with each other, because most businesses today say that the secret of the success in the future will rely to a large degree upon getting technology and business to come and be fused together. Now, AT&T recently, I believe, sponsored a competition, hackathon in New York City, two hackathons, one to increase road safety of pedestrians and increase road safety in general for, I think, cars and other commuters in the city. And what was interesting is both these hackathons were won by teams from Cornell Tech. And what we found was that the teams that were the winning teams, they formed organically by combining technology and business students together. We didn't actually tell them, you know, have a mixed team. They themselves realized that they needed the complementary skills in the from the other population group. So we hope that that kind of understanding which they live and they breathe during the Cornell Tech experience will help them succeed in the future careers in the future.
Yeah, and there's one more example also that's worth pointing out. They have a program called the Project Runway, where postdocs come in. And so Cornell Tech actually funds postdocs to come to Cornell Tech. Right now there's 6 or 8 of them, and they pay them to start companies. So these are students that are actually starting their own companies. They're postdocs. They're starting their own companies at Cornell Tech. Cornell Tech ends up with a small slice of ownership of the company. It's a very creative IP transfer setup that was put into place. So it's a wonderful program. We had one of those teams present up here in Ithaca during celebration last week, actually. It was just absolutely phenomenal. So that is truly innovative.
Another question related, I think it's largely the undergraduates I'm asking about, but not totally. I can imagine that students with an entrepreneur interest and have an idea about what they want to do, what kind of problem they'd like to get engaged in. That's one population, and the support and the mentoring and the facilities and so on here at Cornell are not only exemplary and amazing, but growing. But the other student that I'm thinking of is one that may sort of like the idea of being an entrepreneur. I mean, maybe really like it, but not sure what to do next. May not have that core idea, or may not have encountered an unmet need. And how is that student brought along, encouraged, or mentored, or helped to find their sort of passion that drives them? And I don't think it's easy, so that's why I'm asking.
I think part of that goes back to what Diane was talking about in terms of when people become entrepreneurs. We have, you look at Lee Pillsbury himself. You know, he spent 20 years at Marriott before he went and developed his half dozen companies. So with the concentrations that exist, you know, over at the undergraduate level in places like Dyson and Hotel for students who want to concentrate in entrepreneurship, we're giving them the skill set not presuming they're going to go out and start a company tomorrow, but they may go out and learn how larger companies work, learn good processes, work with good people. But you never know quite when that spirit's going to bloom.
But I do think we're trying very hard to keep alumni tied through things like the Cornell Entrepreneurs Network, through a variety of activities where we're trying to keep the ecosystem vibrant well after people leave campus.
But even while, I think your question really is talking about people while they're on campus.
Yes.
And I would say that's the majority. The majority of students coming through entrepreneurship classes don't have an idea that they think they're going to run. Most of them are intrigued by it. They've grown up in a generation where they have a lot of role models around their age who have started these companies. So they come in really interested, and I think sometimes they come to a speaker series and they see a bunch of role models, and sometimes they go to a design thinking class and learn that kind of tool. Sometimes they come into a business planning process class, where, you know, what you fundamentally teach in these courses is, how do you identify an opportunity? How do you understand the customer, the value proposition from a customer perspective? How do you figure out the operational details that are going to matter? And what is a reasonable business revenue model? And that set of skills you can take into almost any field and really use it. So I think that those are some of the ways, and perhaps a lot of the extracurricular meetups and things like that that are going on. We are just about perfectly on time today, so we'll stay around a little bit if people want to come up and ask individual questions. But thank you for being an attentive audience, and thanks to all the panelists.
Thanks, Professor.